We are 4 years, 5 months, and 7 days into 14 days to flatten the curve. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Johnny Anderson alongside Melissa from Cutting Through the Matrix. Melissa, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you, Johnny.
It is good to see you. It has been a while since you've been on, and I know you're going to be taking a little hiatus from now on, but you will be back. You know, we've discussed that before we started, so you've always got a place here.
Thank
but
you.
Take care of your, take care of your, the issues that you've got to take care of, and we'll be happy to have you back whenever you're ready. But in the meantime, have you watched the three-ring circus that is the Democratic National Convention?
Well, I have not. I got a little bit of my Aunt Betty told me this morning on our way to a little health appointment for her that she had watched it last night. She said she's not a Democrat. And she said, I wouldn't have watched it, but there was nothing else to watch. So she gave me the kind of blow by blow, what Hillary Clinton said and how Joe Biden did. And I listened to all of that. And then I took a quick peek at the reviews, and all of the reviews that you're, well, I should say most of the reviews that you're going to get on it are coming from a very left-leaning, liberal, biased media. That's just most of the media in the U.S. I mean, it's all controlled, but anyway. They all agreed with Aunt Betty.
Yes. Yes, I'm sure that they did.
Yeah. Joe Biden yelled his way through his 45 minutes and Hillary Clinton bashed Trump. So there you go.
It's incredible that Joe Biden can yell his way through 45 minutes at the DNC, yet they say that he's not fit to run for another term and he can barely walk up the stairs of his own plane.
Well, everyone knows that I don't really follow politics, but I was telling my Aunt Betty my theory of what just happened in the United States regarding Kamala stepping in for Joe. I said, we all know that the debate between Trump and Biden was unusual because you never have a debate between two candidates who have not even been, have not received their party's nomination. But that's exactly what happened. And whatever issues there are with Biden, they've managed to keep him functioning just fine throughout the presidency whenever he is needed. I felt that it was an orchestrated event so that they could bring in Kamala at the last minute, as they have, because she never would, for whatever reasons they have for having whichever puppets in at a certain time for the show, it's her time up, or at least her time to be running. That's what I think. So it was orchestrated because, yeah. You know, and there's a few other things. I mean, Biden's brother famously came out after the debate, actually after Biden said he was stepping down and not going to run, continue his campaign. His brother said, well, we all love Joe and we're just grateful that we have whatever time is left to spend with him. Now, some people jumped on that and said, does he have a disease that, you know, but even if it's dementia, you have a very limited window there to enjoy a loved one before whatever's, you know, left of it is no longer there. And certainly that's been alluded to, but whatever, I mean, to me, I've been really clear. This clown show is theater, pure and simple, top to bottom. It's all orchestrated. We don't really have real, politics just doesn't matter. In the big picture.
That is true. And when you look at the big picture, you see, by God, that's Alexander Soros with, is that Bill Clinton? I believe it is. And they're sitting in the luxury boxes there at the DNC. Yeah, looking down on stage there. Yeah, it's a clown show. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Uh-huh. I did see part of the Hillary speech. I was telling you in soundcheck that we were watching, you know, me and a couple other people, we were watching this little thing that they put together, and it was the Law and Order like voiceover for the beginning, the intro.
Yes.
And then they did the Law and Order theme, and then they were talking about all these crimes that Trump had committed. Then it was Kamala, because it's a hate crime according to Mika Brzezinski, if you say anything other than that. Then they introed her, saying that she was the only one that was capable of prosecuting such criminals because of her time as the, you know, assistant AG and then AG of California.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was literally a cartoon show. It was a clown show, you know, to sit there and watch that.
I just said to someone in the Real History that I've got going up tomorrow, it was Neil. I said, how we get indoctrination just nonstop in all of the entertainment that we watch. We're completely getting indoctrinated with propaganda constantly from all sources, all kinds of propaganda, not just political, but how to think, what is green, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, news is just another form of entertainment. So whatever news you're looking at, you're taking in entertainment, and the whole political arena, it's a spectator sport.
I heard somebody describe the election season as a presidential reality show once. Mm-hmm. That's what we're watching. Mm-hmm. It's literally like one of these reality shows that you see, you know, these fake things. They're not really reality. That's the interesting thing about them is they say, oh, these are reality shows, but there's nothing involving reality with them. It's all scripted. No. And it's the same thing with politics. You know, it's everything that has been prepackaged and put together. Did you see the event that, and just to kind of, you know, show that obviously to you, did you see the event that they had at the gymnasium for the Kamala thing right before the DNC launched? Okay. The cameras.
No.
Okay. I'm going to show you what was actually going on. The cameras never panned to the right. They never zoomed out. Everything was always a zoomed in shot. Okay. So this is just before she took the stage. Look at the size of this. But yet if you're to watch the actual event that took place, this is in a high school gymnasium. If you're to watch the actual event that took place, it looks like she's giving this speech to this very large crowd that's there ready to cheer her on. And there could not have been more than 150 people there total.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not watching an actual campaign. You're watching marketing is what you're watching.
Yes. It's everything is so carefully constructed. What the camera is going to show you, when they pan away to get audience response, who they're looking at in the audience. And there's plants. I mean, I learned this decades ago from a friend who grew up in a family that made their living on Broadway, you know, so theater. And they said, you don't have a live theater performance where there aren't plants in the audience. There are always plants strategically positioned, and they start the applause. They start the standing ovation. So this is how theater is done, you know.
And you can see this was the angle that they showed on television. So when all the major networks like the CNNs, the ABCs, the NBCs, whenever they picked it up, this was the shot that they saw. And that shot was then zoomed in. What you saw over here on this side, this was all cut out. So it was just the stage, her walking in on the left there, and it was just the stage and the podium, and that was it.
Sad. It's so pathetic.
It's really pathetic. And you see they've got the Gatorade jugs over there just on the side. You know, they didn't even take those out.
Oh.
Anyway, but yeah, that's that. Her VP choice, all right, Tim Walz.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, I saw an article today. He was one of the VIP members of the Cultural Exchange Program with the Chinese Communist Party back in 1976. He took all expenses paid trips over to communist China, where he was, you see right there, he's having a drink with his Chinese buddies. Yeah, you see that? Yeah. And he was actually, it was on a CIA watch list for a while. But I'm sure there's no problem. I'm sure there's no problem. I'm sure he's not compromised or anything like that. I'm sure he's going to be a good candidate.
Well, he probably isn't compromised, Johnny, because, you know, the West set up China. We happily and willingly sent them all our manufacturing. You know, most voters sat by, even though people like, I can't remember his name, who was the Texan that famously said the giant sucking sound that you're going to hear is that, that's your manufacturing.
Yes, yes. The NAFTA thing when he was with Al Gore. Ross Perot is who you're
Ross
thinking
Perot,
of.
Yeah. I mean, there were
you
people.
You will hear the giant sucking sound.
There were people who warned about what was going on, but this thing with China, I mean, this goes back to, and I don't have it in front of me. Sadly, I can't even go and pick up the book and look at it. But there is a book that was published in 1938, immediately following. It's really essentially the minutes of a meeting that was held by the Royal Institute of International Affairs. That's Chatham House. So that's the British equivalent of the Council on Foreign Relations. This is what Carol Quigley was writing about, you know, our Anglo-American establishment. And in those minutes, the meeting was held in Australia that year. And it really talks about long-term plans that the West had for China and, you know, geopolitically, strategically, how they're going to bring them up. So whatever the facade that we're looking at called communism, which isn't to say that, there's not a lot of real bloodshed. I mean, communism is a terrible system, of course, but and you've got the same thing with Maurice Strong and his family ties to Canada and then to the UN. In other words, there's a machine behind setting up China to rapidly industrialize them. And that's a good thing for communism, because basically then you can just have a committee telling all of the peasants what to do, when to do it, where to shop, how to, you know, your whole life is controlled. That brings them into, then we subsidize them. We give them all kinds of, send our manufacturing over there and give all of the multinational companies who choose to go over there major tax benefits. We don't make China agree on the world stage, not because they're communist and they're rogue and they won't do what they're told, but we simply agree in the West that they don't have to meet any of the standards of pollution or manufacturing or safety or intellectual property rights. I mean, that we could have a whole conversation about China's flagrant rejection of copyright. But all of this has been carefully crafted for about 100 years now, probably longer than that. And now we're like, oh, no. I mean, really, our enemy are the people who manufacture our face masks and our aspirin.
And our penicillin and our vitamin C.
Absolutely.
Would you let an assassin cook your food? I don't think so.
So, I mean, it's tragic what has happened. But these people are our puppeteer masters. They've orchestrated a world that benefits them for resource acquisition, and then who's doing what and how long they're going to be doing it. But we at our level suffer.
Yeah, and
so
to that point,
Tim Walz is just a puppet player.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
He goes over there, and yeah, I'm sure he is getting some benefits. It's just the same thing. You remember Bezmenov talked about how Russia would bring over journalists, and they just basically keep them drunk for 3 days. Basically anything that the Russian rule, you know, their ruling class, their chambers wanted to put out.
Yes. They call themselves.
Then those journalists were going to write it. They were drunk. They actually saw nothing real for the whole visit. And I think we have similar things going on when these little benefit trips happen.
I think in terms of any kind of just in our critical infrastructure, I think that's another poison pill that's been swallowed as well as it relates to China, because we've now linked all of our critical infrastructure, such as our electricity grid, our water and treatment facilities, and anything involving any kind of our manufacturing stuff in the U.S. I'm not talking about overseas, in the U.S. We've linked all this stuff online, and we get the chips for the hardware from China. And do you think they didn't put back doors into all this stuff, you know, ready to trigger it whenever they need it? And we've apprehended, we were counting over 200,000 Chinese nationals on the border since the Biden administration took over. So 2 and 2 equals 4 to me in terms of problems. And I think that's a very serious problem, just in terms of down to the local level, as far as safety is concerned, in my opinion. If you cannot have running water and a working sanitation system in a society, just as a basic necessity, then you're going to have disease and death run rampant. That's one of the reasons that we in the West were actually able to knock out diseases as quickly as we did when we started mass producing infrastructure like that. So when you get running water and sanitation up in a country, and quickly talk about this in Tragedy and Hope that you mentioned, it actually knocks those things out. But if we don't have those things, if those things are not available, then you're going to have an even bigger problem in society.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that this is by design, that this is happening? I mean, do you think that, because I do, but I'm curious what you think.
I do think it is by design. It comes down to a matter of perspective on which design it's actually used for. We have people, and I'm referencing Yuri Bezmenov, because you mentioned him. I'm referencing his point. He says he's warned over and over in the interviews that he gave and in the writings that he published. He said, if you capitalists in the West, if you cannot curb your appetite for profit, you will hang for what you're doing. And I tend to take his warning very seriously. And I think that that's what has happened, in my opinion, just basing off of what he said.
At one level, there is that. I think Alan used to like to remind us that these were experiments, the capitalist experiment and the communist experiment, and the idea that they were going to be merged into a different way. And I just happened to be looking at something right before we started talking that had crossed my desk. It was Bertrand Russell, somebody writing about Bertrand Russell's time in China. And he was meeting with some intellectuals. I think this was back in the 1930s, but I didn't have time to read the whole thing. But he spent a year or two over there, mostly meeting with intellectuals and training them in a way into a Western way of thinking, some Western philosophy. And he famously mused, was it possible to bring Western ideals to the Chinese without having them altogether lose their own sense of who they were? Well, I mean, that's kind of a naive thing to say from, you know, Bertrand Russell, because you're looking at an ancient civilization, a Chinese people who have a very distinct, and they've always been xenophobic and very controlling of who comes into their country and so forth. But it's an interesting thing that he was saying. And the writer of this article went on to say that Bertrand Russell was trying to bring them a third way. Well, Bertrand Russell was famously communist friendly, but still supposedly bringing them a capitalist idea or the Western ideas of philosophy. But I think the most important part of what I just read was about the third way. Toffler, many people have written this. This is the synthesis, really.
You said Toffler. I'm sorry.
Alvin Toffler.
Alvin and Heidi Toffler is his wife, Heidi Toffler. There was a book that they wrote, and I can't remember what it was. I heard it about 15 years ago.
Future Shock, I think.
It could be. Yeah, I could. I just remember the authors is when you said that. And it's been so long since I've heard those names, but it's one of those odd names you just don't forget. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just trying to think of the name of the book.
No, that's okay. I think maybe their most famous piece was called Future Shock. But the idea is that you have a lot of different writers and thinkers who keep coming back to the third way. And that really is what we are at. It was said about the inception of communism, how long, you know, what's the lifespan of this? About 70 years. So we're in this third way now, and we have been, and that's the blending. And I really liked how Alan always put it. He made it's all one thing, capi, commi, fasci. The
gelling of this you see with like Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum. You see this. If you go back and you look at what they describe as a stakeholder capitalist system, that's literally what they have in China. They're reversing everything that we've done here, and they're twisting it back into, you know, this one merged thing, and they're trying to do it under the guise of world government. You know, they're trying to put everybody under this one umbrella, you know, this one economic umbrella. But it's really just state-controlled capitalism, in a sense, is all it is. And there's no innovation through any of it.
That is exactly what we are living through, too, in the West. I mean, we touched on before the pre-record, the UK riots, what's going on in Ireland, just this mess that's happening there. And it's okay, so it's their turn to really get hammered, because you remember Germany. I mean, you were there when they were going through their mess pre-COVID. Yeah. And France had the same thing. You have unchecked immigration. So you have geopolitics, the grand chessboard played out in the Middle East and Northern Africa and Africa, and you've got unchecked migration population. And of course, the peoples who are being displaced are told, well, they're coming into the country because they're, you know, leaving a war torn, a war ravaged country. And, you know, they're seeking refuge here in our country, et cetera, et cetera. And there are various reasons why that are explained, but that's the primary one. So who's behind most of the upheaval in the Middle East? And it's, I mean, we might buy for a moment some civil war propaganda about Syria, for instance. But if you look at the Western meddling there, or, you know, if you want to look at Ukrainian refugees, we might buy for a moment that it's just all the bad Russians, you know, attacking Ukraine. But you've had Western meddling in that situation for decades. So we're not, we in this country, and by we, I don't mean the collective you and me we, I mean our puppets and their Aspen Institute, CFR, you know.
Foreign policy is a failure.
Foreign policy is a huge success. That's what I'm saying.
Well, yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, it's a huge success.
It is a huge success. Yeah, you're right.
But not for us.
No, not for us. Specifically in the Middle East aspect, just specifically speaking of one nation in particular over there that there's an issue with at the moment, Yemen, is where you have the Houthis. Now, I have inside information that I'm not willing to get into all the details of at the moment because it's still an ongoing discussion. But the meddling you have going on in Yemen at the moment is actually by the Chinese funding the Houthis, using them as a proxy to see if they can disrupt global maritime operations and reroute all traffic down through the Horn of Africa around the Cape of Good Hope. That's just a sense of playing economic warfare, if you will. They're trying to see what they can do to the global marketplace. But that's all I can say on it.
There's another interesting element here, too, in terms of bringing China up to a certain level, because they had to be rushed into the high tech manufacturing. You know, it's like Quigley talked about in Tragedy and Hope. There were parts, and Russia was one of them, countries that the Industrial Revolution did not take hold there. You still had a primarily agricultural system.
Yes.
And so
the Marxist system that they've adopted over there, actually, it hasn't played out that way. Because if you look at how that is supposed to play out, they kind of skipped a few things. They weren't supposed to do it like that. But yeah, anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
Well, no, I mean, it's just I think that what they discovered is that theory and practice doesn't cut it. So, you know, it's the idea, I think, here is a kind of global governance for all of us that they want us all under, is standardized in every single way. And so if you look at things that are going on in the US, they rather spookily mirror what you see in China. It's just that we call it something different. So the Chinese social credit system, we really started to hear about that in the West around, say, 2018 or so. I'm just kind of going from memory. And I don't remember the year that they started intellectually thinking about this. I remember it was a young woman and she was highly placed, I think, in the Communist Party. But she came up with this idea and it had to do, this is what we're sold. This is what we're told. Okay. It had to do with low trust. There was so much corruption in the Chinese Communist Party because what you have when you've got a system where it's one thing for the inner party and something else for everybody. And that's really what you always get with communism. You know, you've got the incredibly wealthy people at the top just raking it in. And even if you don't have what has happened in Russia in the last, since they've so-called not been communists anymore, what you have is a kind of Wild West. So it's not really a true innovative ideas capitalism, free market or anything like that. It's using some of the ideas of capitalism, and those at the top are just making an awful lot of money. There's no trickle down. That's what's gone on in Russia. It's oligarchs.
There's a good book.
Billionaire class.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. There's a good book on it. It was written by a Russian historian who actually teaches at an American university. His name's Yuri Felchinsky, and it's called The Corporation. It starts about the time that the collapse of the Soviet Union happened, and Putin and all of his KGB network people actually went into business and politics at the same time and brought in the intelligence services and the Russian mob to, quote, rebuild everything. You know, just to kind of round off and put into context what you're saying, they were supposed to be on these committees to set up new businesses and pave the way for revenue to start being generated by the actual business class, you know, to create a business class to where you could actually have income coming in, where you could raise the standard of living and provide food for people in Russia. They ended up sending all of that money and they ran it through the stock market, through casinos that they set up, and they raked off all the cash and it went to them. It was supposed to go to buy food for the Russian people, and it never did. You know, it just went to enrich themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, because those at the top are those who are used, not at the top, but those who are used by those at the top are always corrupt, and corruption is part of the game. And so what you had in China is several decades of this, and the corruption was obvious to everyone. So they had what was called a low trust society. So the whole idea of the Chinese social credit system, they didn't just come out and say to their people, oh, we're totalitarian monsters who want to have facial recognition and cameras everywhere, want to track you and trace you, want to, you know, fine you and take away your life if you jaywalk. That's not how they sold it to the people. They sold it to the people as something that was going to help them navigate around corruption. And there was a couple of famous things. Now, China famously executed. Do you remember some of the businessmen who were just, boom, tried and executed for their corruption?
Yep.
And all of these things were kind of the precursors for starting out this social credit system. So now what we have in the West is we are going to have our social credit system, and it's going to be built. It's just different language. It's a different way it's being put across to us. But the concept behind it is trust. Our trust has been eroded. We have no trust in our government. So what is happening? What do we see on our level that plays into this? We've got an election here that happened in 2020 that a lot of people doubt was really how it happened. We've got somebody that ran for office that we were told in the press was a madman, a dictator, a fascist, a lunatic. And this is what you're having in the media. They're telling you, you can't trust the process. You not only can't trust the elected officials, you can't trust the process. I mean, there's a famous one. I don't remember his name because I don't follow it that closely. And you might know his name, but he's a congressman or a senator who was just indicted and tried and convicted. And
was it Santos?
He's been. Yeah.
I saw something on him yesterday. He was convicted. He's out of the house.
And I mean, for all kinds of stuff, identity theft. I mean, the charges, it's crazy. But because what we are being prepped for is embracing the idea that we are now a low trust, no trust society. And we can't depend on anything. And I think AI, in terms of, I mean, this is only one of the ways in which AI will be used and used against us. But this is saying you can't trust with your own eyes what you see. Is that news story real or was it generated? And this is how this will be used at this phase. You can't trust your eyes. You can't trust your politicians. You can't trust the system. The electoral process is corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got, meanwhile, now I know I haven't been following the WEF very closely. I know Schwab is out. I don't know who is in. But, you know, the body itself is telling us that blockchain technology is for two things: transparency and traceability of every single transaction that happens. Traceability and transparency. And I've read articles on the World Economic Forum site that talk about trust. We need to be able to trust the transactions. People have lost faith in the transaction. And so this is what it is. The Chinese sold their people. They said, hey, look, in the West, they've got a credit rating, you know, so you get a better loan. You get a better rate on your loan if your credit rating is high. And, you know, there are things that you can do to up your credit score. And if you go to get a mortgage, you want. So this is the way this is sold to the Chinese people, is it's a kind of credit rating. See, Well, they've already gotten us thinking about, well, do I have too many credit cards? Are they too many of the same kind of credit cards?
My social security number was just stolen. Oh, I'm going to need a safer way to keep that. Gee, government, what can you do for me to help me?
Yeah.
Interesting. You were talking about the World Economic Forum. I just happened to just now just toddle on over to their website just to see what they were up to. And lo and behold, yesterday they published this: 4 global risks to look out for in the post-pandemic era.
Huh. Yeah.
And if you remember the COVID-19 passport, the vaccine passport, that was the initial beta test to roll it out to everybody about, you can't trust anybody. So you're going to have to verify them with this thing. And in places like where I was, there was an addition that you could have to that. So you could have it on your phone and your phone would connect with other phones around you in your vicinity and tell you if people around you had been vaccinated or not.
Absolutely.
On your phone.
Yeah.
Now, come on. Right. That's just the ultimate snitch society. OK, so let's look at what they say here. OK, so number one. Right. There's 4 points here. Right. Number one. Power disperses in a post-superpower era. Does that mean that they're going to now split all the countries off to get, away from each other? The G7, the G20 and all that stuff, and the G10 and the G5 and whatever G number they stick out there, right? So they're going to split all that up, right? Oh, and they say that they're going to be moving away from the U.S. dollar, and they're going to be attempting a new blockchain payment system. Interesting. Yeah. And they say that tech firms and leaders, they don't mention who those are driving the change largely unchecked. So you see, you're going to have somebody else in there to tell you exactly how to manage things and how to structure it. Yeah. So they say, just regardless of the outcome of the U.S. election, this still needs to be taken into consideration. They actually say that right there. A big election year won't stop our recurrent crisis of political legitimacy. You mean people are still going? Trust.
I already read this article before it came out.
Trust. Anti-government unrest is reoccurring everywhere since the. You're going to have to trust them, right? You're going to have to trust the system that they give you. Number 3, a more complex global mental health crisis. Gee, you think? Yeah, you think? My goodness. They said the pandemic was the greatest threat to mental health since the Second World War. Yeah, because of your ridiculous policies. According to the WHO, who handed down those edicts, I might add. So, they'll go on here. They talk about AI. Yeah, they talk about AI experts. Mm-hmm. And they say that they have confirmed that this prediction is still uncannily accurate, forecasting that 50% of jobs will be wiped away by 2027. There's a new article out today, actually.
Think about that. That's 2 years away. 2 years and yeah, 5 2 months years. Away. So 2 years. 50%.
And today, the Fed announced up to 1 million U.S. jobs will be vanishing, which is the largest loss of jobs in the last 15 years. So, that'll be out today. And a lot of this stuff, like I said, we're in the process now of retooling in the West. That's the other thing is you've got the Far East, Russia and China and the other nations that they're paired up with. We're retooling for robotics and AI. They are not. So that's going to give us a significant advantage, just speaking economically, because we won't have to make T-shirts in Bangladesh anymore if we do that, will we? If we can perfect that and get it right. So all the manufacturing or whatever manufacturing we have will actually be done by robotics. And that's going to put everybody out of work, especially if you put it in terms of incorporating AI with it. And we looked at some of the robotics when you were on a while back. A lot of the new cybernetic limbs and things that they're doing. I don't want to get into the Elon Musk, shoehorning Neuralink thing, but that's not what I'm talking about. But they have robots that are doing certain jobs now. And they're very rudimentary, but I can see nothing but improvement. So as technology progresses, you'll see that improvement in the manufacturing jobs, the assembly line jobs. They'll have robots for that. So you won't need the factory worker anymore, no matter where they are. So you just have a robot stuck in there. But the last point that they make here, they say an era of shock events. You think they're going to scare everybody into compliance? Mm-hmm. That's what that means, by the way. That's translating what that means. They say, here's the things you need to be looking out for. Top 3 things, according to the World Economic Forum on their website. A new global extremist group emerging. It couldn't be orchestrated or funded or put together.
Well, they always are.
Of course they are. What was it Bezmenov said again, referencing him? He says, whenever you see something that says grassroots, that's absolute baloney. Somebody's funding it somewhere.
Yeah.
Number 2, a cyber pandemic that is intentional. You think, do I need to Do you want me to play the clip of Klaus Schwab talking about a cyber pandemic? I have it. If you want me to, I do have it. Yeah, if you want me to, if you want me to play it.
But still, pay insufficient attention to the frightening scenario of a comprehensive cyber attack, which would bring to a complete halt to the power supply, transportation, hospital services, our society as a whole. The COVID-19 crisis would be seen in this respect as a small disturbance in comparison to a major cyber attack. To use the COVID-19 crisis as a timely opportunity to reflect on the lessons the cybersecurity community can draw and improve our preparedness for a potential cyber pandemic.
Literally telling you what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, number three, climate change. You can't forget about that. Yeah, climate change. Climate change claims its first island nation in the post-pandemic era. COP28 planned to phase out fossil fuels. Like, are we that stupid? Yes, yes, I think we are. They say that it may take decades and that it's unclear if world leaders will follow through on it. But yeah, are we fast enough to act? So there are your shock events and there's your, yeah, that's basically everything you said in a nutshell. And that's
on their website, published yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah. There will be more. It's going to be nonstop. I think there was something that I just saw this morning on the Tragedy and Hope Book Club site on Telegram. Someone who had posted a comment, and I do believe it was a quote from somewhere, and I just was scrolling down trying to glean the high points. But it said something about how rapid change is going to be the continuing theme, the continuing feeling for the forever, you know, for the foreseeable future. And they talked about how much change had occurred between the beginning of 2020 and the present. And it's really phenomenal when you think about it. And it's speeding up and it's just going to get more and more intense. And I think that one little thing that Alan liked to remind us of a lot, we're the most studied species on the planet. But they know that we can handle one crisis coming our way. So say there's an illness in the family or even if it's something external to you, it's a pandemic. But if it's a pandemic with a 50%, that's what you just said, that they were expecting a loss of 50% of the jobs by 2027. So that's phenomenal. And that's going to be a huge crisis. And everyone is predicting some kind of a financial meltdown imminent. Possibly this year. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but one thing I do know is that they're going to hit us with crisis after crisis after crisis. And this is, I'm just speaking for myself and not advising anyone else what to think or how to be, but I've been having a lot of conversations with myself. Am I crazy that I talk to myself?
Are you answering yourself?
Yes. Now, the thinking that I'm doing is, we all go along in our lives and we say what is important in our life from time. And sometimes we have to shift that. Okay, I want to sleep a certain amount and get a certain amount of exercise. And then I want to work this much. And, you know, so just basic, simple, like life structuring plans. And we revisit our ideas and our goals and where we're spending our time from time to time, just managing our lives. And I've done certain things that I thought were important. But, you know, for me, it's Alan Watts' legacy and how do I further that and champion it and, you know, introduce people to, okay, am I doing everything that I need to do, that I think I want to do, that I have to achieve, you know? So that I'm looking at that, but in the gnawing at the back of my mind for a while until it had to come front and center recently, the idea is, I feel that rapid change that they're talking about. I know that nothing is anything like it was when I was 20. And I don't think I've got those 40 years again to see it unfold at that pace. I think I'll see the change of that 40 years in less than a decade if I live that long. It's going to be massive because they have promised us that we are in the fourth industrial revolution. And so the life that we will be living, those of us who are here, it's going to be as different as people coming into the Industrial Revolution from a life of agriculture on a small family holding, or from the Industrial Revolution into the 20th century, into post-World War II, into a computerized, that way of living life. These have all been fairly rapid changes, but nothing like what we're going to see coming up.
I have to agree with that aspect. And this time, it's going to be vastly different. And the reason I say it's going to be vastly different is in each one of these changes that you have described, there has always been the continuation of a workforce. Not this time, is there?
No.
This is going to remove people's purpose.
And then you have to say, am I looking at greed or am I looking at depopulation?
Well,
and I think that we're looking at
Yuval Noah Harari. You know, what are we going to do with all these useless people?
Absolutely. And now I talk to a lot of different people, and I've been shown compelling evidence of a coming cataclysm, but I don't stop off at a coming ice age or polar shifts and that kind of thing as explaining everything for a need to downsize the herd. Because those events, when and if they occur, and cyclically, okay, so when they occur, they take care of their own excess population. This isn't something that our ranch managers need to do for us. But the one thing, because I believe in the long age of humanity, the long age of the earth. We've sustained many. All you have to do is look at evidence. There's lots and lots of lost civilizations that we can find, that we can access. What I'm saying is that cataclysm or no, a certain class of people always come through. What do you call them? The psychopathic, troglodyte. The overlords always come through. But so do some other odd types filter out through that system. Otherwise, there'd be nobody to talk about it or nobody even interested in understanding ends of ages or, as we've discussed here, end of a civilization. But
I think it's where we are, to be honest.
Yes, I think so, too. And I think that, just for me personally, like I was saying, is I'm kind of having this daily or regular commitment to be as unencumbered by old ways of thinking as I possibly can be. And certain things that I don't think have any intellectual currency for me, I'm going to let them go all together. I'm not rejoicing in the end of nations, but it is done. They're done with having nations. They've written about it. You can talk about Jacques Attali, lots of different writers, Charles Galton Darwin, they've talked in one way or another about city-states. And I think we're going into, the UN has even...
That's actually, if we're talking city-states, it's interesting because I was looking through the rise and fall of the Roman Empire last night. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, no, I'm sorry. I'm going to go back further than that. I was looking last night at around 2000 BC, so around 4,000 years ago.
And do you have a time machine?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. I was so envious.
Yeah, I was looking at it, and I was looking at where the world was back then, and it was uh-huh. fascinating. We were in the middle of the Bronze Age back then. Mm-hmm. To give people an idea, 4,000 years ago, the United States as we know it today was actually in a prehistoric stage. So you actually had hunter-gatherers. And that's what most of the planet was. You had a global population of around 100 million, which if you look at what they had on, a lot of these books like Eco-Science and these, John P. Holdren and Paul Ehrlich, these guys, that's what they want. They want that level of population back to where we were around 4,000 years ago. And that is when you had, during the Bronze Age, that is when you had city-states. You had that type of thing emerge back then. The Egyptians were actually ruling back then. That was the center of everything. So,
well, I've had a conversation with Sean Ross, a South African who's lived in Switzerland for years. And, from his point of view, they're still in charge.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It could be.
Yeah. But no, to just on the city state point. Yeah. That's where we were 4,000 years ago. I was looking at a world map from 4,000 years ago last night, because I was doing research on another thing for my own personal self. And it took me back almost 4,000 years. Interesting. Maybe we can talk about that sometime, but
I'd love to.
It was really interesting, because when you sit here and you talk about, and you look at these writings of these people, these like Neo-Malthusians, you know, these eugenicists, if you get into that and you start looking at the depopulation things that they talk about in their own writings, and then you look at the levels that they want to get to, they want to get the human population down to, it's like, well, we're just going right back to where we were, you know, 3,000-4,000 years ago. That's all they want. And if you look at the demographic shift, I'm not talking about the people that are being brought in. I'm speaking just on the demographics in Western nations. Mm-hmm. We're going extinct anyway. You know, if you look at that, and it's not even, I can't even say that it's Western nations. If you look at even the Far Eastern nations, if you look at Japan, their demographics are completely out of balance. The Chinese demographics are out of balance. The Russian demographics are out of balance. So all of the old way that we've known things from the last 100 years, all of these nations, we're all out of balance, and we're all on self-destruct anyway, because we don't have a replenishment coming from natively, is what I'm saying.
Absolutely, because that was never the plan. I mean, you know, communism did it a certain way, and you know, China's one-child policy, Russia's. I mean, I've listened to people, and women in particular, but people talking about coming up in the height of communism, who had multiple abortions, like 6, 7, 8 abortions, because this was, you know, like what
that's
you
still
did.
The average, by the way, in Russia. Those abortion rates are still the average.
Just, yeah.
They don't talk about it, but that's still the average.
I mean, it's horrifying. And it's just something that I was looking at for a completely different project. I visited Pussy Riot, and no interest. I've never had any interest in them, or, you know, kind of like in the back of my head heard, you know, Putin doesn't like them and they were put in prison and blah, 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 you know. But I mean, it's just awful. You know, I mean, they're simply under the guise of feminism promoting what has already been in Russia. They just don't want to see that end, because somehow that's like, you know, women's liberation. But, you know, every country has been worked on in a certain way, but the end result is the same. And so for me, like I said, looking at myself and my time left on planet Earth, I just feel the need to keep the head as limber as possible, you know, because I'm not going to fight. I'm not going to rage against what has already been accomplished. I cannot rage against the loss of liberty when that is already done, or the end of my nation that I thought that I had as a young woman, because this has been on the books for ages. And the UN calls these, I believe, mega cities. I think that is their term for them. But if you look on their site, these are cities that are going to have a population of at least 10 million, but they may have upped that now, because I think the target is for a lot of these cities to be like 20 million.
It sounds like
Dallas.
It sounds like that project that the Saudis are working on called The Line, where they're going to move the entire population of Saudi Arabia into this one.
Yes. Structure. Yes. Absolutely. And you see, I mean, if you want to see, to me, when I want to see what the future might look like, I look at some places like that you'll see in the United Arab Emirates or Dubai. You see, and The Line is a very interesting project. And that's what I see, because I think that, you know, the Middle East has been allowed, some parts of the Middle East have not been bombed out of existence, but a lot of money has been allowed to stay there with their oil resources and so forth. So, and those are the places where you can see, and that you'll see them. You'll see them showing up at these World Economic Forum events. You know, they know that they've been chosen for this. But so we're looking at cities. And Jacques Attali talked about this, and I can't remember which of his books it might have been, Millennium Winners and Losers in the Coming World Order. But he talks about mega cities where we're under constant surveillance. And most of that is self-surveillance. These are the devices that we've already been trained to watch, wear, you know, the Apple Watch. And, you know, so that's what we're going into. So whatever limited amount of us move into this new system, it will be highly skilled workers.
Just the people to do the maintenance and, you know, keep everything in working order. Just a skeleton crew, if you will. That'll be it.
Highly trained workers. Tech.
Yeah. And that's not going. Yeah. That's not going to Westerners. That's going to go to the, you know, the Indian students that are going to do it for pennies on the dollar. You know, that's where it's going to go. Did you see, and speaking of depopulation, did you see at the DNC, they had Planned Parenthood was there with a very long bus, and they were offering free abortions and vasectomies to anybody that wanted to show up. They were just taking walk up appointments at the DNC in the parking lot. How can you not call this? You know, for what it is. And it's, I mean, it hit several, it hit the so-called right-wing news outlets, but anywhere else, it didn't pick it up. None of the mainstream press picked it up.
It's just disgusting.
Yeah.
The other thing that I didn't mention either, we talked about this in the Real History going up tomorrow, though, is they're trialing in five European countries something called the European Vaccine Card, the EVC. And I think we'll have similar, you know, Canada got into trialing something. I haven't followed up on that to see where they are. But whatever they roll out, when they roll out the next pandemic that the World Economic Forum was just talking about in that article that they posted yesterday, they'll be prepared for it with this vaccination thing. Because this experimental mRNA injectable is part of a population management plan. And as many of us as need it, you know, this is why it's being touted as a vaccine for cancer. If you can vaccinate, I mean, just think about this for a minute. If you could vaccinate against cancer, then you could actually cure it, right?
Technically, yes.
Yeah. So why aren't they just giving us the cure for cancer instead of the vaccine for cancer?
You're never going to see that. You are never going to see it. As a matter of fact, the WHO, Tedros, you know, Tedros the terrorist, he was out giving a speech, an official speech the other day, and they have declared monkeypox as as an official.
Except they don't call it monkeypox anymore.
Oh, mpox. Mpox. Yeah. Yeah. So lockdown's incoming.
Well, I was just going to say that I saw a funny little meme floating around that said the key to understanding monkeypox is the K is silent.
Yes. Just get rid of the K and you'll know what kind of deal that is. Yeah. Moneypox. Yeah. Got it. It has been great having you back on. And I look forward to having you back and we'll be in touch.
Okay. Until
you're ready to come back. But before you go, how can people find your work and what do you have coming up with your latest podcast?
Well, there is the go-to site is cuttingthroughthematrix.com. And at cuttingthroughthematrix.com, I have all of the other sites and ways to get in touch, different websites and social. I've actually done a little bit of social media here. So they can find me on Twitter at @AlanWatt_CTTM. And I'm at YouTube, and I can't call that channel out, but it's CTTM. So if you look for that Rumble, there's a couple of channels there. That's Alan Watt CTTM, and I think CTTM2. There is an Odyssey channel called Alan Watt CTTM. I can be emailed at cuttingthroughthematrix@protonmail.com or alanwattcuttingthrough@yahoo.com. And so there are lots of ways to get in touch with me. And I'm still trying to, I don't know what has to get pared down, but I'm still doing the Sunday Redux, which is I do a little introduction and then play an older talk of Alan's, and I'm very faithful to that every Sunday. And then almost every Thursday, I do Real History, and I'm trying to maintain that schedule. And then there will be a few other things as I can. I've got some listener-created content, excerpt series and things like that that I try to post when I can. And there is the Tragedy and Hope Book Club on Telegram. And I don't think I shouted that one out, but that is on Telegram. It's Cutting Through the Matrix Book Club. So there's lots of ways to be in touch and find out. And, you know, the purpose is Alan, his material. I think that a careful listening and re-listening and continuous listening to things that Alan Watt said over the years really puts a person in a good position to understand what is happening and why it's happening. And hopefully people don't beat themselves up because they don't understand what's going on. They don't lose their mind because the changes will be rapid. And it's going to, what we've seen in the last 4 years, it's going to be worse.
Indeed it is. And your podcast?
Real History with Melissa.
That is available everywhere you get your podcasts. Well, it's been great having you, Melissa. I will see you back really soon, I hope. So you take care of yourself, and I will be in touch. That'll do it for us for today. Thank you for being here today. Thank you to all the listeners. God bless everyone. Have a great evening.